So, let's talk about music. My name is Sergio Ferrer, and I'm a composer and a pianist of the classical persuasion. And my guest today is Paul Levitt. Did I say it right?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Levitt, okay. And we met in a Chorus America conference a couple of months ago, and he agreed to be my guest here. He showed me some of his works, and I want to share them with you today. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Sergio.
How are you today?
Good. Nice to see you again.
Yes. It's very nice to be, you know, in different sides of the continent and still be able to talk, you know, and see each other.
We live in amazing times.
Yes. Yes, definitely. So let's start with the first. This is a question I ask everybody. How did you end up being a composer? How did that happen?
That's a great question. I started taking piano lessons when I was very young, like a lot of pianists, and I used to spend an enormous amount of time improvising. And in some ways, I was a terrible piano student because I was improvising all the time and I wouldn't practice what I was assigned. And when I was very young, I used to pretend that my piano was actually a pipe organ. And
oh, really?
Yeah, it's funny, you know. I was really, really taken by the organ very young. But I finally settled in with, studying the piano. And I would write things when I was a kid and bring them into my piano teacher. But she seemed a little less than enthusiastic with the idea of me being a composer. She wanted to turn me into a top competing, pianistic talent, and which I didn't really object to, but it just seemed to be that there was always something else happening. And then she sent me to go work with a composer in upstate New York when I was 11 or 12. And so I started bringing some of my early compositions into him, and he's this Eastman and Juilliard grad and a Fulbright scholar. And, really a brilliant composer and a brilliant musician and, you know, very inspiring, but not somebody who at 12 years old was able to help me structure what I was doing, you know?
Yeah.
I tend to think that in this country, we need to get to musical talents younger so that they can, you know, they can learn theory. They can learn all of this stuff at the same time that they're learning arithmetic and science and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I worked with him for a little bit. And then after a while, I stopped showing him things and was again, you know, training to be, you know, a competition pianist and concert pianist and all that stuff. So by the time I got to my undergrad, I had very good theory at SUNY Purchase and amazing theory teachers. And at one point, one of my teachers, Steve Lubin, he asked me, looking at one of the exercises I had just done, he said, "Have you ever composed?" And I said, I've composed, you know, some things in high school and everything like that. And he said, "Well, would you show me sometime?" And I said, "No."
Oh, really? Wow.
Like, absolutely not. No. Like, no, forget it. You know, and he was a little taken aback by that. And there are other composers in the school, you know, and successful known composers in the school that it just never occurred to me to go study composition with anybody. I was completely turned off by the idea of, you know, being a composer of the modern ilk, that that there was going to be a way to compose, and that it had to be necessarily including lots of dissonance and new ideas. And it seemed challenging enough just to be a pianist, you know, let alone composer. Fast forward many years, I got involved in, you know, very high level international piano competitions and was concertizing. And then I met a new friend who asked me to write some music for a theater piece.
For what? A theater piece. Okay.
Yeah. So I was living in France, was living in Paris, and somebody asked me to write some music for a show that was going up on stage and to sort of play the role of pianist who's playing in a bar. So I had a whole bunch of ballet class waltzes that I had worked up when I was playing ballet classes just to make some money. I improvised some things. And I kept playing these things for him. And he said, wow, that's really good. I really like that. Play it again. Play it again. Play it again. And so I got my first composition gig. The show did well. We ended up touring through France for 2 years. And after that, you know, he was telling me, you know, you've really got to write music. There's something happening here. You have to write music. And still, it always met my resistance with this idea of, you know, what is a composer? What am I supposed to be hearing? How is this supposed to work? You know, when you have a score that's already finished in front of you, figure out how to play it. You know, you work through things and you listen to a bunch of recordings, take some lessons. The ingredients are on the package, you know. You know, the recipe's on the package. You know, add water, stir, put the eggs in, all that, put it in the oven, cook it, you know. And then you can improve on it. But when you're a composer, it's like making a puzzle, but you have to make all the pieces yourself. So when I moved back from France in my mid-30s, that's when I started really taking the whole composition idea a little bit more seriously. And I started sort of showing up for what I was hearing and just writing it down, trying to get out of the habit of saying, well, I should be writing this and I shouldn't be writing that. It's like if a pop song is coming through, we're writing it down. If a piece of four-part choral music is coming through, we're writing it down. If some really dissonant noise is coming through, we're writing it down. Whatever it is that's coming through, we're just writing it down and to really start showing up for the process. And
I relate to that. My job is, I write down what comes. You know, that's the job, I think.
Yeah. You know, there are times when I sit there and say, why is that coming through? You know, why is this piece of like New Orleans jazz coming through? It's like, well, write it down, just write it down. And when I started with the church where I've been working here on Capitol Hill 20 years ago, I came in with some of my published choral pieces. And I think that's, you know, principally why I got hired. I mean, I was not much of an organist at that point because I never had access to a good instrument. But they liked how I worked with the chorus and they liked the pieces I presented with them. And then, so the world of composition, as I composed, my world, my musical world and professional life and creative life just got larger and larger and larger. So the Requiem that, you know, I sent to you actually got premiered, it got premiered on February 15th, 2009, but 5 of the 9 movements actually got premiered in church services.
I see.
Because I would write a piece and I would bring it into my choir and say, hey, do you want to learn this? You know, and they, you know, fortunately, they were always completely on board. You know, anything you want, anything you write, we want to hear it and we want to sing it. And so most of the piece was premiered during church services.
That's great. You know, I was looking at the Requiem text. I'm Jewish, and I've written sacred music for Jewish. I wrote an oratorio about Moses. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at the text of the Requiem and I said, man, this imagery, you know, such a treat to write to this stuff, because it's the images, you know, it's just like hell and the devil and the angels and the martyrs and this and that. And it's like, oh my God, what you can do with this stuff, you know? I mean, image-wise, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
The text, that's why so many people write this stuff. I said, why are there so many records? Well, I see.
It's a great text, it's an amazing text.
The text is amazing. I totally agree. It's interesting. I'm going to go into the piece because I was listening to it yesterday. I want to go into the last two movements, mm-hmm. if it's okay with you.
Sure, absolutely.
The next to last movement of this work is called Liberame, deliver me. And the Latin says, deliver me, O Lord, from eternal death on that awful day when the heavens and earth shall be shaken and you shall come to judge the world by fire. I am seized with fear and trembling until the trial is at hand and the wrath to come when the heavens and earth shall be shaken. Okay, now let's hear. It's a very interesting interpretation of the text, and we're going to hear it right now.
Dies magna et amor.
Okay, that was really beautiful.
Thank you.
Very effective too. Yeah, the reason I chose this one to talk about because the harmonic language that you use is modern, and yet it's not dissonant. It has dissonances where it has to have them, but it has plenty of beauty. Especially, there are some duets there that are really great. They are really magnificent because you are not really tonal. You know, when you look at it, it's not exactly, you know, and yet it doesn't sound, it sounds beautiful through the whole thing. So I think that's where a lot of composers like me are trying to get, where we can write beautiful things that doesn't sound like the old beautiful things.
Yeah, it's funny. I just had a former student come here yesterday and hang out for a couple hours. And he just finished up his degree in new media composing up in Peabody, the Peabody Conservatory. Uh-huh. And, you know, new media is really, you know, composing for films and composing for video games and things like that.
Right.
And there's real style. And he has always had that. Even when he started working with me as a high school student, I mean, this was his focus. And he was really, he's really developed a lot of stuff. But he was talking about how a lot of the main composers at the school, they were like, you know, if you're a tonal composer, then you sit on that side of the lunchroom. And if you're an atonal composer, our side of the lunchroom, and never the twain shall meet, you know. That's... And, you know, and I thought that was interesting because that was always something that I was resisting as a composer, was just to be sort of engulfed in this world of theory and theories about what makes a good piece. And, you know, and especially this whole idea that we have to be a new, like a musical Davy Crockett all the time and, you know, create a new path through the Cumberland Gap musically, you know, that we have to be these pioneers. And I, the way I look at it is that, you know, we're very fortunate. There's a lot of people who have, you know, who've opened up the creative terrain, you know, immensely. Pretty much everything that can be is shocking in music has been done. I mean, you know, I mean, for the most part, or at least there's no limit to what you can put into a piece anymore. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we as modern listeners have caught up with that kind of material. And a very close friend of mine had worked quite closely with Leonard Bernstein. And Bernstein always said, you know, we can't get around, you know, right now we're not able to get around tonality. Like, there has to be, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you have to have a place to come home to. And one of the things that, this was the hardest movement for me to write. And I think symbolically.
Yeah, it's compositionally, it was by far the most interesting one. I really was totally absorbed by it because it has elements of both worlds. It has the tonal elements and it has the atonal elements, and they are so well mixed because you know you can follow the melody, right? But yet it's not the same old stuff, and that's all we have to do, I think. It has to sound fresh. It has to sound a little different. I mean, a writer doesn't have to develop the English language all over again.
Exactly.
He can put, if he has two words from a book going to the language, like Orwell with 1984, like Double Think, like Big Brother, like, okay, so he got 10 words into the language. Wow, that's amazing.
It's already a lot.
I know. Who does that, right? But as a musician, you're supposed to be doing totally new stuff all the time. Like, we're all reinventing music. And I said, you know what? As long as it sounds fresh, and it sounds interesting and is also beautiful. You can make something interesting that is not beautiful.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
But what's the point? For a while you can do it, you know, for a couple of minutes of ugly, intense ugliness, you know, for a purpose. But the whole thing?
Yeah, and there's, you know, if we're going to consider ourselves in the line of, you know, say from Monteverdi, Handel, Bach, Mozart, Schubert, you know, Beethoven, Liszt, you know, Chopin, all that kind of stuff, Shostakovich, you know, and so, you know, and so on, Messiaen, and everything like that. I think the overriding goal of a composer is to write an effective piece, a piece that works. And I'm glad that we can draw on the language of dissonance. I mean, I love the Musique Commission, you know, and I read his, you know, his book is Technique de mon langage musical, you know, the techniques of his musical language and all that kind of stuff, because he was just a fascinating thinker about how he did, you know, about how, you know, how he used numbers and rhythms and created these modes that were just fascinating. But, you know, a lot of when I started writing this out, it was more like, you know, the whole idea liberame for me also means free me.
Exactly.
And so make me free. And when I heard the piece, when I was reading the text, I was thinking more, you know, the whole Catholic interpretation is to free me from eternal death, you know, eternal right. hell, you know. But I was looking at more about, you know, free me from the fear of death, because I don't really believe that on the other side of, you know, after we live this life and we leave this body and all that kind of stuff, that we're greeted with this huge laundry list of everything we did wrong. And oh, by the way, that's where you're going. You know, I have always had trouble believing that. And nothing that I've read in sort of the esoteric world has led me to believe that that kind of phantasmagorical Dante-esque world exists. You know, maybe I'll find out that I was completely wrong about that. But if for today, from where I'm coming from as a musician, a person, as a composer, I have a lot of trouble believing in this big fiery hell afterwards. But that aside, I thought, what would it be like to write a fugue on with tritone entrances? You know how you write a fugue theme and then you go up the fifth,
right?
But what if you went up the diminished fifth, you know?
Right.
So basically all the entrances are climbing up a minor third.
A minor third?
A minor third, right? Etc., you know. So that so you're basically writing a fugue or a fugetta on this, you know, the diminished seventh is like the chord of fear, you know. Will she leave her husband? You know, will they find out? You know, all the, you know, they used to use these chords in soap operas all the time, you know, to, you know, the it's the fear chord, you know. And to write a fugue theme that is basically, you know, vacillating back and forth between these two diminished sevenths or these diminished chords,
right?
And then exploding into this, you know, thing on the G pedal, you know. You know, so that you've had all of this, you know, this counterpoint, this development, fugal development on a diminished chord, and then it explodes into G minor. Without ever having the intention of it ever resolving. There's no 5-1, you know, pretty five. It doesn't resolve, but then it morphs into, you know, polyrhythms of taking the text and tremens factus sum ego, tremens factus sum em. I have mean to tremble, you know.
What does the three words mean? The one that you use for
So tremens. Uh-huh. So trembling. Tremens is trembling,
right.
Factus, sum ego, meaning that trembling made am I.
I see. Okay.
I am made to tremble, you know, and I'm caused to tremble. And so then you have the whole chorus, on stage chorus of people singing just like this fear mantra that's very easy for them to do. I mean, it's not a complicated thing. You know, there's very little variation. So you're sort of picking up on the sort of minimalist, you know, Steve Reich, you know, John Adams-ish, you know, this thing that keeps repeating and repeating with tiny little variations, the minimalist idea, but with an overlay of a melody. And then also to bring in the counter melody, which is actually the Dies Irae.
Okay.
You know, liberame Domine de morte eterna. Because the Dies Irae chant, which Rachmaninoff used to use in a lot of his pieces, it, you know, would show up. You know, I thought, well, there's a great place to sort of sneak this in.
I see. You know?
But not with the words Dies Irae, you know. But with actually the text that we're singing.
Of course.
And so all of these different layering of ideas, you know, as again, as I was sitting there composing it, I'm sitting there saying, you know, where on earth is this going? You know, I see we're in this, but how are we going to get out?
But that's the fun part of it. If you knew, I think when you're in the process of creating and you just let it come out, it happens, right? You know, if you let it.
Yeah.
You know, I think you have to trust. So I don't remember the person that said it. A composer said, you have to trust the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wherever it takes you. I think it's more you have to trust yourself. where are you going to take yourself? But
And trust the process. I have a very close friend that I met in New York when I was in my early 20s, and we were both working in this high school for the arts in New York. And he would always say that he, as a composer, he felt much more like he was an eavesdropper than a composer, that there was sort of all this music around in the spheres, and he'd just sort of reach up and, you know, like, you know, almost like you're picking fruit off of a tree, and he'd just pick these ideas. And so he said, I don't really compose, I eavesdrop. And that idea has always stuck with me, you know, that we trust the process of how these things are all going to come together. And this was the premiere of this, that the chorus got the final score of this 3 weeks before the premiere. And so this is when we got to movement eight, everybody was a little bit terrified, but it all came off quite well.
I thought also the Liberame, it gave me the impression a little bit that it was like freeing you from previous conceptions and stuff. You know, it gives me that impression that we have this piece that is going in a certain way, and then you have this movement, and it's like a freeing thing.
Right. And it, for me, it was really stepping into, writing a choral and symphonic work on a very, very grand scale, that, you know, where, because one thing you don't really hear too much in the background of this piece is not only do we have a full orchestra, but we have pipe organ going on as well.
Yeah, well, the recording has to bring out the singers more because that's the nature of the beast, but probably in a hall it would sound quite a bit more impacting.
Yeah, you'd hear the brightness of the mixtures and the reeds, and then the lowness of the low bass pedal notes, and you could feel the walls vibrate.
That's a nice sensation, isn't it? When you get those low notes that just, the whole thing just go.
Yeah, especially at the end, which is sort of the postscriptum of taking the first theme of the first movement and writing it out in major.
I see.
But with the words Liberame.
I see.
And then having the super, super peaceful, sort of like a drone, like, you know, those Tibetan chant, you know, the monks chanting with really super low notes, you know, because one thing that I really love in classical music is the super, super low notes. And especially in choral writing, where you can have people singing with their really, really, really lowest notes. I just think it's magnificent, magnificent sound.
Yeah, I agree.
It speaks to everybody's bodies. Yeah.
When you hear a real bass, when you have a real bass in your ensemble that can hit those notes with full breath and everything, it's just like, okay, everybody shut up. This guy.
Yeah.
that's the impulse, right? Oh man, I want to hear more of this.
Yeah, I went to go see a local production of a Mozart opera here, and that featured a bass, and there's a local bass here, his really magnificent voice. And, you know, and you always expect the soprano or the tenor to steal the show, but the bass,
Yeah.
Everybody was crazy over the bass. I mean, crazy over this voice.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be a great effect. Okay. We're going to go to the last movement, In Paradisum. Let me read the translation of what we're hearing for our audience. May the angels lead you into paradise. At your coming, may the martyrs receive you and lead you to the holy city of Jerusalem. May the chorus of angels receive you, and with Lazarus, once poor, may you have eternal rest. One observation, the reason I wanted to do this movement is because it doesn't take you where you would expect. It's a very nice treatment of it. It's an arrival in paradise, but it's not corny or trite, or, you know, it leads itself to such a so corny, you know, arriving in paradise and all the cliches, all the musical cliches, you could pile them up there.
Right.
Right? But you didn't. And this is why I want to share this with our audience. Okay, it's amazing. I think that ending is that solo at the end. You I saw those notes. That was high. But it's very beautiful how it ends. The last phrase is about eternal rest, right?
Yeah. Thank you. It's interesting. You know, I love the whole, Carl Jung used to talk a lot about synchronicity. And
who? This,
Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst.
Right.
Talk a lot about synchronicities. And while I was writing this music, I was singing with the Choral Arts Society of Washington here. And I had just joined the year prior to that. And we were invited to sing Mahler's Symphony No. 8.
Right.
At the Kennedy Center a couple of times and also at Carnegie Hall. And then we were invited to the City of London Festival to sing it with the London Symphony Chorus. And Valery Gergiev was the conductor. And it was a really, really, really big deal. And I had always heard about the Symphony of Beethoven, but I'd never been part of it. And so here, all of a sudden, I was singing like 10 performances of it. And I just found it to be the singularly most overwhelming piece of music I had ever been part of. It's just the energy of the piece is just, say what you will, but the concept of it was just so enormous. And to have these double choruses and, sound coming at you from every direction. And when I got back from London, I thought, what would it be like to actually try to do a little bit more double chorus, in the last movement? And so different portions of it started to come together. And then, it really started to expand. And then I got to the end and I started hearing all these super high notes. And I thought, I've been showing up for this whole process and saying, but now, whoever's feeding me all this stuff, you people are crazy because no one can sing that. No one, get it. My skepticism really took over. And so about the same time, I was contacted by a young woman here locally who was soprano. And she was just one of those people who had a freakishly high voice. Even when she sang the Queen of the Night aria, it sounded low in her voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Most people are happy that they get the F.
Right.
She had almost a full octave above the F. Almost a full octave that she could vocalize and do all the time.
Wow.
Yeah, she was singing up to high,
Really?
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, insanely high voice.
Yeah, sometimes you can barely hear it. It becomes almost like a dog whistle,
Well, oddly enough, Mariah Carey has those notes. She can go up into the tippy top octave of the piano.
Oh,
and still go very, very low. Yeah, there's some astonishing things in the voice. And so anyway, I said, I've written this thing that's kind of weird, want to come over and read it. And I put it in front of her, it's still a manuscript, and it just comes right out. C sharp is no problem. C sharp was like the middle. That C sharp was like the middle of her voice in some ways.
Wow.
Getting her down to a middle C. That was a lot of work. But so I said, can you come and sing the premiere of this? And so I thought, we've got this person who can do this, and then we'll see what happens for the future of the piece. Maybe this is just going to be for this performance. And then she came to every single rehearsal from that point on. And every time we were rehearsing the last movement, she'd start, she'd sing the last people, and people were just in a state of shock. this gorgeous tone that was very, very light and had no vibrato and it just soaring over. So anyway, we get into the final dress rehearsals and she comes up to me and she's very eager. She says, how do I sound? Do I sound good? And you sound amazing. You sound completely amazing. But is there any chance that you have the high F sharp at the end? Can you leap up to the high F sharp? She says, oh yeah, I'd love to do it. Let me just go downstairs and warm up. So I hear her downstairs in the choir room warming up. And then she came in for the final, just before the dress report, and she popped out the high F sharp, and it just took their breath away, And so she did that in the first performance. And it was so ethereal and it was so perfect. I mean, it was just so completely perfect. And it's not like I went around hunting the internet or, it's just this person just showed up at my house one day, through a series of friends. And that's the thing I love about the synchronicities of, of composing, because that, I'm sitting there saying there's no one who can sing that.
And then there it is.
And, yeah, and then I find out that there's a whole bunch of sopranos who've been waiting to be able to do a line like that, you know, a soaring line like that, you know. And then, but it is, you know, for anybody who takes on the piece and wants to perform it, you know, it's, I always say you're going to need a fifth soloist, you know. The tessitura on some of the pieces for the soloist is insanely large. You know, I'm very aware of that. But again, following the theme of we write what we hear,
right?
I've never had a problem with finding people who could do what was there on the page. So, you know, and sometimes you adapt things. We just did the piece in Amalfi, and the soprano we had said, you know, I'll try to get up to C sharps, but it's not really comfortable for me. And I said, don't worry about that. And I just, you know, and I just pull, you know, open up Sibelius and, you know, move some things around. She says, I think I'm good for one C sharp, but like a whole bunch of them, no. So we just rework things, and she was magnificent, you know.
Yeah, but it's yeah, another thing that I like about your music is that you use a lot of four voices, and so I think sometimes it takes more skill to do four voices than to add six or eight voices, because you really have to know what you want to hear. You really have to select carefully, and the harmonies are very interesting with four voices, you know?
Well, I think for so many of us as composers, I mean, for me, harmony is just my heaven, you know? Some people, their focus is really on rhythm, and some people it's on melody, some people it's on words and stuff like that. But for me, harmony, I have always been just captivated by. You know, I remember the first time I learned a Liszt etude, and I was just like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing. You know, or when I learned a Liszt transcendental etude when I was in my teens, and I thought,
I see.
This is the greatest thing I've ever, you know, that was ever written. Or the first Scriabin sonata that I ever played, I just thought, oh my God, this is so amazing. You know, it's, you know, no one should ever have to pay to hear me play Mozart, because for me, it's a little bit too plain, you know? And I mean, the harmonies in Mozart are wonderful. It's delicious music, but what I really gravitate towards is, you know, this very exotic. And so for me, in the opening statement of the last movement, I wanted to include as many harmonies as possible. So we started having this sort of idea of a harmonic lava lamp, you know, you're starting off in one key, and then you just sort of bubble up and you're in another key, and where did it go? And how did you just slither and slide into that one? And, you know, you try to include as many as it could.
It works very nicely. So I want to thank you very much for sharing this with us and with me, and to be able to chat. I think probably this will be the first of, I hope, many chats.
Oh, thank you so much for your invitation. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this.
Yeah, you know, our background is very similar. I started as a concert pianist, and I couldn't get into composing until I thought that what I was writing was of the same level or comparable to the things I was playing. I think that being a pianist and playing all these great repertoire puts you against the standard that you say, really?
A little daunting.
Yeah, it is daunting. It is daunting. Until you write something that you say, oh, this is not bad compared to that. And then you feel like, yeah, you know, maybe I can do this. And then it takes a lot of writing to get there. But
what I found the most troubling about the whole thing about becoming a, you know, really taking compositions, you know, seriously in my mid-30s and not just sort of, you know, writing down some things, was that I had to become a beginner again.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
It's one thing to sit down and play, you know, an F sharp major augmented 11th, you know, with all the different things, and, you know, and go into all these different pieces, you know, and, you know, I've played, you know, pieces of Messiaen in public. I've programmed a lot of that stuff. I've played plenty of Scriabin in public and Ravel and all that kind of stuff, but I love that music. But it's another thing when you sit down and start thinking, well, I'm going to start writing those things too. So I completely get that.
Yeah. No. And it's one thing is what you can play, and another thing is what you can grab, you know, from up there and put it down, you know?
And how it's all going to fit in. Yeah. True.
So anyway, thank you so much. I really
thank
enjoyed
so
it.
Me too.
And I hope to see you soon in some kind of a something. So That's all, folks.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks, Sergio. It's been a pleasure.